Welcome to Mountain Whispers Podcast. This is a show exploring the deeper lessons we learn from the outdoors. If you're joining for the first time, welcome. Here I chat to interesting people within mountain culture about the way that the outdoors has transformed them, their most vivid experiences, and how themes like risk, fear, flow, or deeper connection show up in the relationship to the outdoors. Today I chat to Lauren Bond. Lauren's a guide and outdoor leader, the founder of The River's Path, which offers canoe journeys for deeper connection and personal transformation throughout Colorado, Utah, and a number of other places. If you listened to this podcast before, you'll know that one of the key threads being weaved and explored is that below the surface of the modern day maxim of touch grass or the conventional wisdom of spend time outdoors to help your mental health is a wellspring of meaning, belonging, and transformation that can be found. When we spend time getting to know a particular space, particular forest, ridge of a mountain, or bank of a stream, there's a longing to reconnect this present, to let the forest in, to dissolve ourselves into it. Lauren founded The River's Path to support this longing to reconnect to the land and find a profound sense of belonging to the river and all her inhabitants. Her core vision is that by reconnecting to the river, participants will find their center, their purpose, their desire to have a positive impact on their community, both human and more than human. Now, that deeper connection possible is where the name Mountain Whispers come from, and it's the idea that we explore in our conversation. As you'll hear Lauren mention, this connection, this resonance is natural in children. However, it's something we're typically socialized out of by modern dominant culture. And Lauren points to how we can relearn this as adults. Now, if this connection is that I'm pointing to is foreign or even feels a little woo-woo to you, perhaps a frame that will help is the concept of the Umwelt. Now, this has been popularized in recent years by the neuroscientist David Eagleman, and I'll paste a link in the show notes with an intro to this. But the idea is that different organisms have a different range of sensory perception as to how they perceive reality. You know, and humans have their five senses, whereas a blind bat uses echolocation. Their entire range of external reality comes down to air compression waves. Or the tick, the tiny parasite infamous for carrying Lyme disease, is blind and deaf, and its entire frame for reality comes down to temperature and the odor of butyric acid, or where they can find blood. The point is, humans, and you can presume these animals too, assume that their Umwelt, or their particular range of sensory perception, is the entirety of reality, whereas it's just a mere slice of it. You've probably heard the metaphor of four blind men grabbing a different part of the elephant, thinking they know what an elephant truly is, yet having four completely different accounts of it. Knowing this, I would suggest that the state of consciousness where you can feel that belonging to nature, to the more than human world, is an extension, a widening of the Umwelt. It's there. It's just a question of whether you can tune or expand your perception to access it. Now, if you've felt this state, this conversation will help you get back to that point of intimacy more often. Or if this sounds foreign still, I would encourage you to keep an open mind throughout. And next time you're in a beautiful wild space, suspend your disbelief and skepticism and see what you experience. Now, as part of this, Lauren shares how she first was able to open herself up to this and how she goes about leading experiences with others to tap into that transformative space of belonging. We talk about how mindset can be a challenge to access this space. For example, very often, my mindset in the outdoors is objective focused. There's a summit I want to get to. There's a line I want to ski. There's a trail I want to ride down. And while that's a powerful state to be in, that state is focusing the Umwelt. Lauren talks about how her trips intentionally go slow and have an abundance of layover days to make space to tap into this wonder. We talk about synchronicity and how often it appears in these particular physical and conscious spaces, as well as the teaching role that comes from confronting fear. It all blends together in a beautiful conversation. It's a beautiful slow build as we get acquainted with each other before really dropping in. I'm excited for you to listen. Here it is. Lauren, welcome to Mountain Whispers.
Thank you.
Well, I'm really excited to dive in here. I think a good place to start would be, do you want to share a little bit more about where you're at in both space and time right now?
Yeah, I think that that's actually a big part of my story, is how I ended up here. But I'm currently west of Loveland, Colorado, on an 800-acre ranch, living in a tiny house that I designed with the help of my mom and graph paper. Yeah, so that was, I live in pretty much a dream. You know, a few days ago, there were probably 500 elk right outside my door, and they were making the most amazing little sounds. Like, I mean, you know, like not the bugling that I'm used to, but it was just, it felt like just whispers. So it was, yeah, I live in a really amazing place. There's ponderosa pines outside. It's actually howling wind right now, but it's still really beautiful.
Wow. And how long have you been there? How long have you had the tiny house for, and how long did it take to build?
I've been here for 4.5 years. And yeah, it from the time that I got the idea, and this is a big part of my whole story. But I got the idea in September 2018 and started the process to actually build it in December 2018. And then it was finished and I moved in August of 2018. My door just opened. I'm going to close it. Okay.
That is a very quick and efficient build. But I'm excited to dive into how that leads into your story. Tell us a little bit more about how or when you first started hearing the whispers from the mountains or from the outdoors.
I have been, I started camping when I was 5. I was a campfire girl, also in 4-H and Girl Scouts and a nature club. And, you know, pretty much my extracurricular activities growing up were camping. And so I started teaching outdoor skills, helping with classes at age 10 and mostly with campfire. My mom ended up being the leader of several of those clubs and then also became the director of this camp in West Virginia that I grew up going to. And then on the board of directors for campfire in the region. And so, yeah, so this place, Tuckahannow, is probably the first place. And Camp Tuckahannow was a place that I spent much of my time from age 6 to 18. You know, going there for, generally it was weekends, and we had various weekends that had different themes. And then as when my mom became the director of that camp, we ended up going up much more often because we'd have to go up and prepare for various events that we had. So a lot of the time it was just my mom and I that would go and spend time there. So it was 200 acres just outside of Harper's Ferry in West Virginia. And that was the place that, you know, I was bullied quite a bit in like elementary and middle school and didn't really feel safe to be myself, I guess would be a way to say it as a child at school. My parents were great, you know, and I had friends, but really Tuckahannow was the place that I felt like I could most fully be who I am and who that was. I started out, you know, some of the first books I remember getting when I was like 5 were little Audubon nature guides, and I would take them out and I'd try and identify every plant and animal and bird, generally things I could touch or eat, pick up, you know, so reptiles and amphibians and berries were my first fascinations. And then I would like go to my mom and make sure that I had the right identification before I would eat that berry, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, so I'd go around, I'd find box turtles and salamanders and snakes and bring home tadpoles and things like that. So, you know, one of my favorite things at Tuckahannow was walking along these streams. There were 2 streams on the 200 acres and they were very rocky. And so I would try and like walk on the rocks and see if I could, you know, see how far I could go before I, you know, stepped in the water, which usually wasn't very far, but I found the most amazing little spots, you know, places where wild mint was growing and Concord grapes and, you know, just various, you know, wild raspberries. And so I just found the most amazing little spots all the way through. And so really that's where it started, was there. And, you know, I was supposed to have a buddy for all of these things, but my friends stopped wanting to go because I was taking them places where they were like crawling on our hands and knees through brambles to try and get, you know, get through to see what's on the other side. And so I was constantly getting in trouble for that and for being barefoot when I wasn't supposed to be out there. But yeah, so that was really where it started. And I had more of a connection to Tuckahano than any place else in my life. It was the first place that I felt like it was a part of me. And I felt most like I was, you know, I felt most myself there.
Yeah. And when did that turn into wanting to form a career around that?
You know, so I went to college for animal behavior and environmental studies. And so career-wise, like I couldn't picture myself in an office. I couldn't picture myself doing a traditional career, but I was thinking maybe being a, you know, veterinarian or psychologist or something. But really what happened for me, the way my path became clearer was in 1999. It was 1999. I was 21 and I had just gone to a conference on religion and animals in Massachusetts. And I was coming back down from there with a friend and we were stopping at like every waterfall in the Delaware Water Gap, just because I had a topo map and they were all labeled. And so we stopped at all of them that we could find. And then there was one that wasn't on the map called Raymondskill Falls. And so we went over and there's like an overlook to one very pretty waterfall, another overlook. And then you look downstream and the water disappeared again, but there was no trail to that. So we hopped over the fence and went down and found ourselves with a waterfall just about 2 feet from us. There was a rock jutting out into the river. And my friend and I sat there and it was the first time in my experience, first time in my life where time disappeared, space disappeared, my friend disappeared. The only thing that was there was the waterfall and me. And I was going through, you know, I had just a few months before that, I had broken up with my first love. And I was like, I was totally heartbroken and just trying to like, so I just started asking questions and it started out with, you know, what do I do with this heartbreak? I was really, really down. But I started getting little bits of wisdom. Like I was hearing this, I started having a conversation with the waterfall. And it was the first time that I had something so clear. And some of the things that I heard had to do with this man that I was, you know, heartbroken over. And some of the things had nothing to do with that. And one of the things the waterfall told me is wind is the voice of spirit. And I was like, oh, yeah, felt true. I could feel the wind coming from the waterfall and soaking me with mist. And that was the first time I realized that waterfalls create their own wind. Like, I mean, the wind was, you know, blowing my hair and soaking me. And that felt true. And so when I walked away, and I have no idea to this day how long we were there, maybe it was a half hour, maybe it was several hours, I don't know. But when I walked away, the colors were brighter than when I went, than when we went down there. And I could see every detail. I could see every movement. I could see an ant crawling and I could see the wind blowing it through the tree, through the leaves. And it was like, and everything felt like, you know, that time when as the sun's about to set, there's that moment where there's a glow, where everything is just almost technicolor, surreal, you know, that's what it looked like, but it was the middle of the day. And that was when my life changed, that moment. So a few months later, I was at a conference that it was sponsored by the Orion Society. And it was anyone who's anyone in the nature writing world was there. So it was great. There were a lot of authors that I had, you know, read their books, but they were there and I got to hear them speak. And one of the things that happened during that conference is we were in a small group with like, there were about 20 of us and each of us, and this happened each day for about 2 hours for the 3 days of the conference. And we were in a group with a nature writer facilitating a conversation. And my nature writer was David Abram. And David Abram, wrote a book called Spell of the Sensuous, which I hadn't read yet. I hadn't heard of him, but you know, it's looking at language and how language affects our sense of connection to our perception of the natural world. And so unprovoked by me, he started talking about words from different languages where the meaning was mistranslated when translated into English. And the first one that he talked about was the word ruach, which is a Hebrew word used throughout the Old Testament of the Bible. And usually it's translated as spirit. But he said that's not what the original meaning was. That's part of it. But it also means wind and breath. And I burst into tears. I was like, I heard this before for the first time 2 months ago. And then he talked about the word spiritus, which is the Latin root of our word spirit. And it doesn't just mean spirit, it means wind and breath. And he talked about all these words from languages around the world that where wind, breath, and spirit were synonymous. And I realized I didn't imagine what the waterfall told me. And that's the moment where I realized why I'm alive. And I didn't know how, I didn't know what, but I knew that there's wisdom out there. There's wisdom out here that we've forgotten how to listen to. And that the reason why I was alive is to help people remember how to listen and how to just be able to have that relationship with the land. I mean, I've gone back to that waterfall many times since then. I haven't had such powerful conversation since, but there's a level of familiarity and love that I have for that place that, you know, will stay with me forever. So
wow.
That's how it started.
Thank you for sharing that. And I mean, that's such a beautiful story. It's also not necessarily an outlier. I've had many people come on and share similar stories of transformation or dropping into a deeply mystical space in nature like that. And I mean, it's even more beautiful that you then get a name from it from someone like David Abram as well. But a large part of what this project is trying to articulate is the means to be able to cultivate intimacy with the more than human world, or how one can cultivate an intentional practice around it, because so much of it is remembering. And something, a continuous theme is the feeling that this is something that us as mammals are deeply hardwired to be deeply connected to our environment. And it's not something that we've kind of been deconditioned from it, but it hasn't gone away.
Yeah, I think it's still a part of us. And the neat thing is, you know, when you think about children, I've had amazing conversations. I went into, you know, my career started as an environmental educator, an outdoor educator, wilderness guide, river guide, you know, that sort of thing. But I had the most amazing conversations with kids that would say things like, oh yeah, I talk to the fairies outside of my house all the time. I mean, I remember this girl, she was probably in fifth grade and she was serious. And I was like, the neat thing is that I believed her, and I bet a lot of adults don't, but you know, for me, it doesn't, you know, these conversations don't feel like they're showing up from a little mythical flying being. For me, the conversations are coming from the trees themselves, or from the waterfalls, or from the, you know, from the birds and the animals. But I think that it's something that is trained out of us. You know, people are like, oh, she's imagining things, but that's not real. You're just pretending, you're playing pretend. And the thing is that I think that there's this wonder that we're born with, goes away over time for a lot of people as their focus moves on to other things. And as those, you know, if there's not space for kids to go and play outside, then they lose that. They forget how important that is for them and how happy it makes them and all of that. And, you know, and I'm, of course, maybe that's not true for everybody, but I can say that, you know, I've worked with preschool age and they all have it. They all have some piece, some bit of wisdom or wonder or something that they're fascinated by. And so I think that that's a big part of it. We have to cultivate it from the start and validate that, you know, that it's really important to have the space to slow down, to be outside. And really, I think that that's a part of it that I found when I, you know, worked as an environmental educator. It was kids and adults, and it was at a nature center, you know, and I did various programs. But the thing is that what was missing from that is that we had to stay on the trail. We were like walking through nature. We were visiting nature. And I was like pointing out plants and animals, and we couldn't pick up a snake. We just had to look at it. We couldn't eat a berry. I got in trouble once for feeding my, you know, for like, we found a mulberry tree. And so the kids and I were like climbing the tree and eating, and it was great. And then we went over to this pond that was in an open space, like public space. And we all took off our shoes and we're walking in the pond. And then somebody that lives on the other side of the pond called a ranger and said, "Oh my God, there's kids wading in the pond." And so a ranger came out and was like, "Yeah, you can't do that." And then I was like, and I was being super friendly. And I was like, "Have you tried any of the mulberries? Oh my God, they're so good." And she's like, "You're supposed to leave those for the birds." And I was so mad. Like, the kids aren't going to remember if they stay on the trail. What they're going to remember is wading in a pond, or, you know, finding catching tadpoles and bringing them home and watching them turn into toads, or climbing trees and eating berries. And, you know, it just, it felt like that wasn't the right space, because there wasn't the space for, you know, to actually have a relationship. It's like we were visiting, we were in a museum. And then we go home from the museum back to our four walls and air conditioning, because that's where we belong. And it just didn't feel right to me. So, yeah. And then when I went, and then that kind of led me to moving into being a wilderness guide. And I worked for a couple of different companies, and it was better, but I felt like the focus was destination. It was about the destination, reaching the top of the mountain or making sure we reach camp on time. And I'm like, "Oh, but there's a butterfly. Oh my God, there's, look at that waterfall. Let's all leave the trail, drop our packs and go there." And, you know, one of my favorite memories from those couple of years leading trips, we were backpacking along the Lost Coast in California. And so it was about 25 miles. We were hiking about 5 miles a day on the beach, camping on the beach. It was awesome. But my favorite moment from that is there were like 100 harbor seals just sitting, swimming in the water. And then a bunch of them were on the shore. And I was like, "Oh God, this is..." So I took, you know, we were taking a break, having a snack, and, you know, and I started like crawling toward them. And anytime that they would like move, I'd stop, you know, and then I end up like crab walking on my back, you know, and I'm like, I'm trying to move as slow as I could. I wanted to see how close I could get. And I turned around and half of the kids and the other guide were following me, and we're all crawling very slowly and carefully. And it took like a half hour to go, what, you know, it might've taken us 2 minutes to walk there, but we didn't want to scare them. And so there was this rock outcropping kind of coming up onto the beach. And so like we snuck behind it, and then we could like poke our heads up and look. And one of the 16-year-old boy just looked at me like, I mean, his eyes were so full of wonder. He was blown away. Like, and we were like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." And I mean, all of us, you know, there were the other guide and I, and then four of the kids, we were just staring at each other like, "I can't believe they let us get this close." Like, and we stayed there for a little while, took some pictures, and, you know, and then when they all left and went back in the water, then we, you know, crawled back so it wouldn't scare them, and then got up when we were far enough away. And the other four kids that were sitting there waiting for us, they're like, "Oh my God, you guys were there forever. Can we go now?" And I was like, "You just missed the most important, the most amazing experience. These four kids just had the most experience of their lives, most amazing experience. And you sat here and you talked and got pissed off that we were taking so long, but you missed the most important part of this whole experience, this whole month that we're traveling together. You missed it." And a lot of the time there wasn't the space for that. Like, we had to keep going. We had to like, and for me, it was about the journey, about the magic that we were finding, like little tidal pools with a million different little creatures in it. If you stop and get on your hands and knees and look, and there wasn't space. We had to go. We had to get to camp. You know, we had places to be. So there wasn't time to look at, you know, to look into tidal pools and follow harbor seals and, you know, and go chase butterflies and find ponds and waterfalls and, you know, build dams on little streams. There wasn't space. And I tried to make the space, but it wasn't the right fit. And So I felt like there was something really big missing from both of those experiences. And so for me, I had to step back and have this whole existential crisis, really, of like, well, if I'm not a wilderness guide, then who am I? What am I supposed to be doing? And that is how I ended up starting the River's Path, starting my transformational canoe outfitter. You know, a friend would get kind of mad at me every time I would call it a canoe outfitter. He's like, it's not that. It's, you know, but I don't know, transformational canoe outfitter, something. It's about the journey. It's about the magic of being out there and being able to go slow enough that there's the space for that magic to happen. So, yeah, so I think that's really the biggest thing, is having that intention to be open, to be curious, letting our heart follow, like, you know, we just follow whatever calls to us. And then those whispers happen. That magic happens. But if we're so focused on the destination, or we have to stay on the trail and, you know, not interact, then we're going to miss that magic.
Absolutely. And you've so beautifully pointed to that opening, that space of wonder that so often comes about. And you pointed to, it is inherent in children and generally something that as adults we have to rediscover and cultivate, and a lot of people don't necessarily get back to that place. What I also find interesting, and I constantly find myself in tension with this, is finding enough space to let the wonder in. You know, I get a lot of joy and reward from objectives, from climbing a mountain, from seeing how much distance I can cover in X amount of days. And I very much, when I'm on a trail, feel almost a sense of momentum pulling me away from that moment. And I'm curious if you experience that tension, one, and then also how you intentionally make space for wonder in the experiences you lead.
I've always been a very slow hiker. Like, because, I mean, I don't know. I saw this little meme once of this, you know, naturalist, this hat, you know, walking with a friend, and they're pointing out all these things, and they're like, oh my God, isn't this amazing? And his friend's like, we've gone 3 feet. And the naturalist was like, but look at all the things we saw, you know? And so I've always been that person, you know, where I've gone on guided hikes, things where people were like, my God, Lauren, you're so slow. Can you hurry up? And this is constant, because I'm constantly like, oh, what's that? Oh my God. It's just, I think for me, it was inherent, you know? And so I don't necessarily get that focus so much while I'm hiking, but maybe in other things I can get really hyper-focused and kind of forget to stop and eat and drink and all, you know. I'm going to show you this mug that I'm drinking from. So this is from a manzanita burl, and I carved this. Well, I'd like to talk about this land that I gathered this from, but that land burned in 2021, June 28th. That place burned completely. And it was just a few months before that I brought these home, all these burls. Like, we'd been pulling them out to try and restore this land to a healthy forest. And so we were pulling out these bushes, you know, manzanita, and then there's these burls like under the ground where the roots go down and the branches go up. And some of the old burls have, I mean, they're huge. And carving them, if you look closely at this, there's so much, there's so many patterns. So I was like, oh my God, I'm going to learn how to carve. This is going to be the thing. And anyway, I would spend 10 hours straight just carving, forgetting everything. And I can do that, you know, or trimming a tree, like the person that I was, you know, tending to that land with would get so annoyed at me, because he's like, okay, you have been working on this tree for 5 hours. We were going to go on a hike. Can we go? You know, but for me, it was like, so it's not necessarily the destination, but I can get like hyper-focused on something. And then I don't necessarily notice what's around me or physiologically what I need, you know, or what other people around me need. But But in that, you know, I fall in love with the tree that I'm trimming, or I fall in love with the burl. This cup has been with me on every river trip that I've led since I finished it 2 years ago. And it's a testament, it's an honor to that land that I loved that burned. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So does that answer your question?
It absolutely does. And pointing to how, the balance between kind of that focus of objective orientated mindset versus really like a spacious mindset mm-hmm. for letting that which is present to come in. And I've found over the last 2 years, it's been a very slow process, but a process nonetheless of me being able to cultivate a deeper intimacy with the more than human world through processes of practices like sit spotting or really kind of reading poetry to nature, etc. But it requires a level of intentionality nonetheless. I'd love to read what you have on your website around the art of belonging. You define the vision of the river's path as to support those longing to reconnect to the land, to find a profound sense of belonging in the river and all her inhabitants. I think that, and it speaks to what we're dancing around and presencing right now. I'm curious if you could speak a little bit more to that vision and how you go about it in the experiences you're designing.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, that was the wordsmithing, but trying to figure out how to take this thing that I'm trying to do with the river's path and actually put it into a sentence. That's really hard. But I can tell you what I do, and really it's about time. It's about going slow enough, having enough space in the schedule for the magic to happen. So you know, I do day trips on the St. Vrain River, which is east of Boulder and Longmont and Loveland, you know, here in Colorado. It's about 40 minutes from my house. And so I do day trips there, and we do 4 miles and a half a day, and you could easily paddle that in an hour. And we take at least two and a half to three hours to float that, because there's eagles. And if the eagles fly overhead, we're going to stop and we're going to hang out and watch the eagles. And once they fly off, then I'll share all the cool things about eagles. I'll, you know, I mean, that pair that I've been watching them since 2010. And, you know, so I can tell there's lots of really amazing stories, amazing like experiences and facts about eagles that I'll share, but only after we've spent our time just watching them. And, you know, we always stop and jump in and swim, as long as grownups are harder to get to jump in than kids. But usually if there's kids in the group, then the kids will start with me and whoever my co-guide is for the day. And then sometimes the kids will be able to drag their parents in. But, you know, it's super fun. But also there's like, when you're actually floating in the river, you feel the current. You feel how when your feet go into an eddy in the side, suddenly you start swirling around. And, you know, and a lot of the kids are like, it's like a lazy river, you know. And it's like, no, actually, it's the other way around. The lazy river is trying to make this. Trying to create this, but this is the real thing. That's, you know, man-made. And there's no eddies in that. There's no like sandbars and cliffs and fallen trees that you can jump off of into the river. Like that part's missing out of the, you know, the lazy river at your local rec center. So part of it is just the pace of going slow and giving the space for the magic to happen. You know, on my trips in Utah, I do week-long trips, and it's 45 miles. People usually will do that trip in like 3, maybe 4 days. And I take, my preference is to take a week. And so it's about 4 days of paddling, and then we do 3 layover days in there. And that's give or take, depending on which trip it is. You might have, you know, might be a shorter or longer trip. But because if you're just floating through and camping and then leaving, then you're not really getting to know that river. You're not allowing the magic of Labyrinth Canyon to flow into you and become part of you, and allowing the space for you to become part of this canyon. So the layover days are an essential part of all the trips that I lead out there, whether we're spending them like taking naps on the beach and jumping in and swimming all day, or hiking in some side canyon, or, you know, I've partnered with several well-known musicians and artists and, you know, writers, poets, you know, so sometimes we'll do workshops or things on those layover days. But really, it's about the magic of being there. And you have to have that space for that to happen.
Yeah. And let's dive into that a little bit more, Kit. Is there any more you can share about how you cultivate that, or maybe any stories that come to mind of particular participants or students where it's clear that they had that level of conditioned separation of them from the more than human world, and you've been able to hold a space that leads to the river becoming part of them and them becoming part of the river, of breaking down that separation?
Well, you know, what's interesting is it doesn't matter where someone comes from, what their background is, whether they've camped before, canoed before, whether they're terrified of water, whatever. Magic always happens on that river. It always happens. Something changes in every person that floats that river, even if it's not apparent in that moment, or it's not apparent to me. You know, there's one woman that came on a trip that she was pretty quiet. You know, it was a women's rite of passage trip that I did. And she was pretty quiet. And, you know, like other people are like pouring their hearts out, sharing all their, you know, what's going on for them emotionally, and, you know, the grief that they're working with, or like recovering from the trauma of, you know, of abuse, or of losing somebody that they loved, you know, to somebody that's passed away, or, you know, dealing with cancer or whatever. But this woman was very quiet. She didn't, you know, and she, like, she had her intention. She had, you know, and she shared her story, but it didn't feel particularly like mind blowing to me. I mean, you know, because she didn't have that, like, sometimes when someone's telling their story, you can see this, like, as they're sharing their story after their solo, like, their whole body opens up and their eyes get wider and they start looking up. They start looking at everybody and they start looking at everything in awe and this, like, wonder. But that's not what I saw with this woman. And a couple of years later, I got an email from her. And she said, you know, I want to let you know that your trip was the catalyst that changed my life completely. And I ended my relationship, sold my house, bought a cabin in Tennessee. You can come visit anytime. And I, you know, she was a doctor. And she's like, I closed my practice. And I just finished a day of doing telemedicine while I'm watching the sunset over the Pacific Ocean out of my RV. So thank you. And I was like, I had no idea that any of that happened or that any of that was possible, you know, but there's something crazy changes with any, I mean, I expect that you've had some of this also happen with you. And, you know, it's just like the effects continue trickling through your life if you give the space for them to. And it, so that's one example of, yeah.
That's a beautiful example. And for, you're right. I mean, and part of this project is that it's had, the artist had a profound impact on my life, and I'm wanting to understand it more. For me, interestingly, I did fall in love with the outdoors as a kid. What got me into the outdoors was growing up, my life surrounded around track and field. And I learned a lot from the discipline of testing or pushing the physical limits in an athletic sense. But it was also very dry. It's not very fun to impose suffering on yourself. And when my athletic career ended, I was looking for something to do next, and I'd always been curious about doing more hiking and biking and things like that. And for me, what was so powerful was that I was able to get that meaning of testing myself physically, but I also just had a number of experiences of just the wonder that we've been pointing to in this conversation of spending time outdoors. And it's been a process over the last 5-10 years of me slowly deepening that relationship and kind of trying to mend that separation or reconnect that separation that I'd been conditioned into. And what I love about that story is that it wasn't necessarily the explosive unlock within the container of that trip. It was the slow burn of a spark that slowly smoldered into that.
Well, one of the things that I've had other mentors say this, but also I experience it. The ceremony is not just that 3-day solo, and not all my trips have a solo. It's not just the week on the river. That's the beginning of the ceremony. And actually the ceremony begins when you say yes, and then all these weird things happen, and there's all these different, like, well, a lot of reasons why you can't go because this crisis happened or this person needs you or whatever. And so there's this severance, this like, what do you need to let go of to be able to be here? But also that it's like, there's this little bit of insight that happens. And then when you go home, that's a whole other part of how do you incorporate this into your life? Like this is the, you know, in the rite of passage world, we talk about severance and then threshold, which is that where you're stepping into something new, you're stepping into the ceremony. That's kind of the crux of it, the climax of it. And then there's the incorporation, which is where you like bring that back home. And the ceremony continues. I mean, I had a solo I did a solo for my 40th birthday, which was in 2018. And I can't tell, it keeps going. One of my mentors said, at the end of a solo, she was like, this shit is real. I didn't know how real until I did that. And I was like, oh my God, my life is completely upside down. It's been a hard almost 6 years. I'll be 46 in like a couple of weeks, but oh my God. Anyway, I want to actually ask you a question, looking at the track and field and you're kind of moving from that, you know, running through, you know, running through a space to that slowing down and having that magic. You talked before we started recording about flow and that's some of the work that you do. And, you know, when I did my thesis for my master's, I read Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but you know what I'm saying? You know, and that feeling of flow that, which I know you get when you're when you're running or when you're hiking or when you're like, and I think that there's a relationship between that sense of flow that you get when you're running and you get in that mindset where suddenly time disappears and you're all that's there is your body and every bit of like what muscles are firing and what, you know, and the people that can get into that are the ones that win the races or reach the top of the mountain or all of that. But also I think that there's a lot of relationship between that feeling of, you know, being in that fully present moment and feeling and sensing every part of your body and every part of the motion of running. I think there's a big relationship between that and sitting down and having a conversation with the tree and having time disappear and having this bit of insight and this like, and then suddenly you notice all of the like the smell, like, you know, ponderosas here smell like caramel, they smell amazing, but everyone smells different, you know, and like being able to notice that and notice the texture of the bark and all the beings that live in it and all the sounds of all the birds, and you know, and so I'm curious about your experience in moving from being, you know, track and field and hiking and moving into the magic that ended up with you starting this podcast.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. No, I know. I see what you point to, and I'll do my best to present it. Essentially, I see flow states as a catch-all term for the altered state of consciousness where the self disappears, you know, that monkey mind internal critic quiets down, time dilates, and that is exactly what you experience in that waterfall that day, whether or not time slows down or whether or not time speeds up, or you have no idea how much time passed. And there is a sense of effortlessness or embodiment. It feels like you've got a greater sense of agency over every cell in your body and perhaps some cells outside of your body. And then an additional level of richness or salience in the environment that you're navigating. The signal becomes clear within the noise. And if you use that as a catch-all state, you experience that in running by being embodied, but also being able to more effortlessly reach your physical limits. There are days where you just do not want to push yourself, where there are days where it feels good to find the limit. That was like in my athletic career, on a race day, there's two factors. There's one, how fit and conditioned you are. And then there's two, how willing you are to actually push yourself to your physical limits. And there was a bunch of races I won where I was not the fittest person in there, but I was willing to actually explore my limits. And there was also races where I pushed that too far. And I literally collapsed 50 meters from a finish line once. But that was the kind of flow state that I've cultivated growing up. What I've been a lot more intentionally working on the last 5 years or so is a lot more softer of a flow state. What we've kind of been presencing, the wonder, the awe, which comes from there is some form of senses that I'm not sure, maybe you know a word for it, and whether that's a sixth sense or whether there's actually a name to speak to, the awareness that opens up in these spaces where we're more sensitive to whatever energetics are taking place or however you label it. But regardless, one often tunes into themselves more clearly. They know who they are. They know what they stand for. They know where they're going. And really what in the work that I do at Flow Genome Project, it's around access to these states. What I find most juicy is the flow states that one accesses in natural spaces. I don't even like that word. In the more than human world. And I think there is an art to that, and I think I still know I've got a very cerebral framing, which is perhaps why I'm trying to, part of this exploration is to speak to a path for people who are still somewhere along the journey of trying to, of knowing there is something inherently transformative about this space, but not being able to open themselves up fully, And I think for many people, that experience is fleeting. They know that they feel better in nature. They know they maybe feel that yearning for more, that seeking to really get to know or to belong in these spaces or to find wonder from it. But it still feels like it still feels fleeting. It still feels
like
it's impossible.
Oh, so gosh, where do I want to go with this? Quickly, first, I've taught skiing for much of the last 20 years. And I know what that flow state from an athletic stance, I know what that feels like. And, I can ski moguls really, really, really well when I'm in that state. And if I'm not in that state, I suck. Like it's really incredible the difference of, my physical ability didn't change from yesterday to today, but yesterday I was kicking butt and today I can't link three turns through this big pile of moguls that I just skied perfectly yesterday. So I know what that flow state feels, and I know kind of the difference of like how, when you're feeling that and when you aren't, and how you perform.
How do you presence that experience or consciousness in the experiences you're facilitating?
I think the word that I would say is allow, to allow something, because, or to like be open to recognize everything is significant, everything that your attention focuses on, everything, and just to take that moment to just follow that interest, that, seeing the shadow of a bird on the canyon wall and then trying to figure out where the heck the bird is and realizing it's a raven that's flying, that's like that big, but his shadow is huge on the wall, and so being able to just like follow your senses and follow your, follow your wonder. So I think that's part of it. But there was another piece too. After that waterfall experience that I talked about earlier, I had a whole other series of like crazy experiences, one after the other, of like times where I was just in I was like in an altered state for months where I was looking around going, oh my God, where is the next lesson? Where is the next thing? And some of those happened. Like I had this amazing experience with Western Red Cedars on the Olympic Peninsula a few months later. And then I went to Brazil for a semester and I had some super amazing experiences with, you know, with some capybaras, the world's largest rodent. They look like huge guinea pigs. They're super cute. But, you know, but then they all stopped and suddenly there was nothing. There was no lessons. There was, and I was like, where did it go? And I'm sitting there searching, like, where, what am I supposed to do next? And I'm looking and I'm trying and I'm asking and I'm like, and I'm so focused on what I'm searching for that I was missing the synchronicities and the magic that was happening around me. If I'm so focused on this is what I'm looking for, by God, I'm not going to find it. Because the answer is probably not going to come in that direct way. It's going to come from a from some place that feels like out of left field. So, so I had the realization that it was about allowing the space, allowing the magic to happen. And so the questions that I was asking, the attention I was setting, it had to be open. You know, it wasn't like, okay, should I go to Naropa for grad school or should I get a job? But what, you know, I mean that's just an example. When I heard about Naropa, my grad school, I knew. But that's just an example of like, you know, it's like either or. If you have an either or question, then you may miss that maybe there's some other completely different answer that you weren't looking for. And since you're looking at this either or, you miss what the other answer should have, you know, what the other thing is. So, so once I realized that and went back to this openness, then these weird synchronicities started happening again. And it's not just for me in the natural world. It's also the, you know, a conversation with somebody that I happen to be in line with, you know, or whatever, like, you know, or a, so one wild example of that. So I trained to be a rafting guide in Pennsylvania when I was in like 1998. And it was a really hard time. I did not have a good experience. The guy who was in charge was a jerk. And he was the first of three different supervisors, owners of companies who told me I wasn't cut out to be a wilderness guide or a river guide. And, you know, I got everything from I lack confidence to you're too self-centered. I mean, opposite ends of things. And so anyway, this man that I... this man that told me I wasn't cut out to be a river guide. Really, he was a catalyst why I'm a dang river guide, because I don't like being told that I'm not cut out for something. I had to prove him wrong, you know, and also he's the first one that made me get in a kayak and I learned how to do a wet exit at the put in. And then I went down a class 3-4 river. And because I knew every place that people had died on the river when I was swimming toward them and the commercial trip that I was with was gone, I'm like pulling my boat to shore saying, I'm going to die. Like literally, I am not going to survive this trip. It took me 5 years to get my role in my kayak and another 2 to get it in the river. And it was because of the fear instilled in me. So I had this hate for this man. I was like, if I ever see him again, I'm going to tell him, you know what? You were wrong. You know, I am a river guide. I've been a river guide for most of the time since I've known, you know, since you told me I wasn't cut out to be one. And so I drove across the country from Colorado to Maryland to visit my parents. And on the way back, I had a friend who's an ER doctor now, who was like, hey, there's this party in Ohio Pile, Pennsylvania. Do you want to go? Because you used to live there, right? And I was like, yeah, that's where I trained to be a rafting guide. And so I was like, yeah, I should go back. I want to go back and see the river. Sure, I'll go to this party. So this is a synchronicity. This was 13 years after that experience. Turns out my friend John was friends with a guy who was friends with the owner of the company that I worked for. And this was an employee party for that company. And it was like December of 2011. Like, there's this employee party. So I end up at an employee party for the dang company that I worked for. And I went up to it was like, they had a shop, you know, and that's where it was. And I like went up to the person at the register and I was like, does he still work here? I'm not going to say his name just in case, you know, and she said, yeah. And I said, are there any other female guides? Are there female guides working for this company? And she said, No, it hadn't changed in 13 years. It was because I'm a woman that I wasn't cut out to be a river guide. I'm not strong enough. I don't, you know, whatever. He showed up. He freaking showed up. And I was so, I panicked. I was like, what the hell? What do I do? You know, and so I like disappeared into the bathroom and I sat there and I was like, I've been waiting for this moment to tell him, F you, you know, how dare you? How dare you tell me that? And then I realized, wait, no, I can't. That's not what I'm here for. I mean, he didn't just magically show up in my life again so I could go and tell him he was a jerk. I realized I was there to thank him. I was like, and that's the thing that came to me. I was like, are you serious? Really? Thank him? And so I thought about it and I realized that actually my life changed because he told me I wasn't cut out to be a river guide. But I am. And that's because of him. I realized that I'm divorced now, but the man that was my husband for 10 years, I met him because I worked at a kayak shop because I wanted to get over that fear and get my role. And he was taking time off for being a software engineer to, you know, and he was trying to write a novel and he was working as a kayak instructor. That would have never happened. I would have never met him. That 15 years of my life, that relationship, which was a good relationship, would have never happened if it weren't for this man that now I'm in the same room as him. So I went out and waited for a break in the conversation. And I said his name and he just stopped and he looked at me like I was an ant that he just needed to smush, you know, like just like, who the heck are you? And I said, you don't remember me, but I trained to be a rafting guide with you 13 years ago. And 13 years ago, you told me I wasn't cut out to be a river guide. And I've waited a long time to tell you. That's what I've done for most of my career since that time. And he said, are you yelling at me? And I said, no, I'm thanking you. And he said, do you want some wine? And I said, yes. I don't drink much, but by God, I drank that wine down so fast. And I'm shaking and I'm crying. And this is like an employee party. Everybody's all cheerful and stuff. And I'm like sobbing and talking to this man, this conversation that I've been waiting to have for so long. And, you know, but we ended up having this amazing conversation where I realized, you know, you hear about the butterfly effect. You hear about, like, you know, the flap of a butterfly's wings can change the course of everything. And he was my dang butterfly. And he's still a misogynistic, chauvinist jerk. Like, he's not a good man. He's not great. But that ended up with me giving him my business card of my company and saying, if you ever end up in Colorado, I'd love to bring you on the river. And he said, if your car ever breaks down anywhere near here, you call me and I'll come get you. And I got closure. Synchronicities don't just happen with a gray jay who sits there and hangs out with me while I'm and teaching me about fearlessness. It's not just in the natural world. It's actually when you have that openness for the magic to happen, then it happens everywhere in your life. And the other two people that told me I wasn't cut out to be a wilderness guide, I ended up getting closure with them in a very similar random way that clearly wasn't random at all.
Wow. That's such a beautiful story.
Thank you.
And it is funny. One could explain away synchronicities as random habits that our mind is assigning it to it. But there is something about the moment that you do at least accept them, they start to show up a little bit more. And that is a perfect example of a teaching moment or a moment to overcome fear that got presented in the form of a wink from the universe.
Yeah.
One of the underlying themes of this project is finding right relationship with fear. And I think the outdoors is the perfect teaching ground for that. And that is a perfect story for the opportunity to confront fear. I'm curious if there's any other experiences as we kind of wrap up here around fear or any other wisdom that you've learned from the outdoors.
Yeah. Well, fear is a good one. As I mentioned, the gray jay, I was leading my very first like solo experience. And it was just like the people were solo just for a couple of hours. And I was off by myself for those couple of hours too. And this gray jay was hanging out with me the whole time and like staring at me and, you know, and I'm looking at him and I'm like, you have no fear. What? You know, he's like checking to see if I have food. I don't know. I mean, he was a couple feet from me. I was like, what is going on? And I realized, you have no fear. What would it be like to not have any fear? And I looked and I just watched that gray jay flitting around in the tree above me and landing right in front of me and checking to see if I have any food for him. And I was like, that's what it's like, you know, that. And so after that, I had no fear for like 3 days. I was like, wow, this is what it feels like. It was amazing. And then later on, I did another solo, like before I started leading my own rites of passage. And fear was represented in that one by a road grader. I was down at the bottom of this canyon near the Dolores River, and there's, and, you know, and I'm alone, like there's nobody around. This road dead ends into the river, and this road grader freaking comes down and goes past my sight, and I'm terrified. I'm alone, like, you know, being a woman solo up there with, it's dangerous. It can be dangerous. I'm not afraid of animals. I'm not afraid of wildlife. I'm afraid of people. You know, I like men, but if I see a man out in the, while I'm backpacking alone, I'm going to probably hide because, you know, so this guy comes down and this road grader is like, oh my God, what? And he went down to the river and he stopped. And I'm just like, what is going on here? And so like, I'm covering my ears and I'm singing and I'm begging it to go away. I'm like, just leave. And was like, okay, well, this represents my fear. And my question at that time was like, what is holding me back from starting to do the work? When am I going to know enough to be able to actually start doing the work I'm alive to do? And I realized on that I was just terrified. Like, what if I don't know enough? What if it's not, you know? And anyway, all of my wishing this thing to go away, it didn't work. And so I just started going about my business. And as soon as I just accepted that fear was there, the thing started up and left. And I realized that the fear is not going to go away, that it's the doing that allows that fear to dissipate. I'm never going to know enough to be the expert. I mean, even at this point, I've been on Labyrinth Canyon 55 times and still unexpected crazy things happen every time. And it's through the doing, through the dealing with that, whatever happens, that I realize, wait, I can do that. I can deal with a flash flood. I can deal with a fire. I can deal with howling wind that creates 5-foot whitecaps. I can deal with a swamped canoe. I can deal with whatever it is. It's through the doing that the fear goes away, because then I realize I can handle it. It's the fear comes from the anticipation, the what if, you know. I mean, of course, there can be fear in the moment if you're, you know, in certain, like if you're falling while out, you know, while rock climbing, yeah, that fear is real. But a lot of the fear is about anticipation of what might happen, or fear of like, oh my God, this thing that happened last year is going to happen again, you know, trauma responses. And so, but it's through the doing that the fear goes away. So that's one of the things that I've gotten from, that I've learned from, well, a road grader, a juniper, and a gray jay. I've had a lot of experiences with American dippers. Do you know what they are? Have you ever seen? I think they live in BC. Okay, so they're this little boring gray bird, boring looking little gray songbird that lives in streams. So like, you will never find them. They're the only fully aquatic songbird. And they're amazing. They build their nests under waterfalls using moss, and the birds, the babies learn how to fly before, or learn how to swim before they can fly. And they like swim, they have like see-through, basically goggles, like eyelids that they can see through, that they, so they can see under the water. And they like swim under, you know, they swim upstream to like eat little aquatic insects. That's what they live on. And so I've gotten a lot of lessons. Another thing, while the reason why they're called dippers is that they sit on these rocks and they just bounce. And I don't know what the evolutionary purpose of them bouncing on these rocks, but the first time I saw one, it was in 2001. I was doing a solo with Naropa University, where I went to school, and this bird just sat there and hung out with me for all 3 days, and he just bounced on this rock. And you know, the thing that came to me is to remember to dance. And I'm not a dancer, so it was really more about like just not taking everything so seriously, just being, you know. And then later on, every time I see a dipper, there is another lesson. So one of the times I watched him going after all these aquatic insects, and I realized that it's time for me to go after what I need instead of just waiting for things to show up, waiting for the, you know, sitting there and waiting for a fly to come land, you know, for this dipper to have his meal. He's going after what he needs. It's like, oh, and then, you know, and then another time he said, you know, just embrace who I am fully. And, you know, said a lot of other things, but, you know, just a matter of like, don't hide so much. You know, Marianne Williamson says we're all meant to shine. And I, you know, the dipper was basically saying the same thing of letting myself shine. And, you know, I've had a porcupine tell me he was trying to crawl in my lap. And I realized that every time I stomped my foot, he'd turn around and like stick his quills up and then say, and then he'd like look over his shoulder and be like, well, how about now? Can I get in your lap now? And they turn around and he'd come back to me and he'd get on his hind legs, showing his like vulnerable belly. And as soon as I set that boundary, stomp my foot, he'd turn around and walk away. And I realized I didn't have any emotional boundaries. So anytime somebody would yell at me or say something or whatever, and I would be like, oh, that hurts. But I never like turn around and say, okay, do your thing, you know? So there's a lot of lessons, but those are some of them. But my life is completely guided by those lessons. And I can come back to that. Now I hear a dipper, like, you know, there's a rest area in Glenwood Springs in Colorado on I-70. And there's a dipper that lives in a stream there. And I heard him and I was like, oh my God, come here, to the person I was with. And there he was, you know? And so I look for them, because every time I see one, there's something significant I have to pay attention to. So anyway, that's
Yeah, finding those impetuses for inspiration and wisdom, or triggers to be able to tap into that deepest sense of wisdom, is so powerful. And I also love it that what you shared about fear, that there is something deeply liberating of taking action, of utilizing and embracing fear for the information it presents to inform action, as opposed to letting fear inhibit action. You know, and I think a relationship and intentional practice in the outdoors is something that allows for that.
Can I tell you quickly? I did a coach training. With one of the things that really stuck with me from that was that we were looking at how emotions show up in the body, and actually, and what he said is the only difference between fear and courage is breath. They both feel the same, but with fear, we're not breathing, and as soon as you breathe, then you can move. And that changed my world for sure.
Wow. Yeah. And I've experienced that as too, the ability to almost turn nervousness into excitement. You know, if you can slightly transform the meaning of something, it completely changes how we react to it and the results from it. And I think that's a large part of like what one can form an intentional practice around. Well, Lauren, I do have a hard stop. I really wish I had more space, because I'm sure we could chat for hours more. I'd love you to share how people can learn more about you and what you have to offer.
So my website is theriverspath.org. That's P-A-T-H. And so I have 4 trips coming up this spring. One is building labyrinths and walking them, ancient meditation practice. And then I'm doing my 3rd retreat with Craig Childs, who's a really amazing nature writer. So we'll be doing a writing workshop. Both of those are in April. And then in May, I have 2 women's retreats led by wilderness therapists. So one is May 4th through 11th, and the other one is May 12th through 19th. And you can find all of that information, as well as on my day trips, on my website, so theriverspath.org.
Amazing. And I'll include that in the show notes so people can just access the website from there.
Okay.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to connect with you.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to talk with you more at some point. And, you know, I think we have a lot more to talk about. So
we absolutely do.
Thank you for listening to Mountain Whispers. Like I say, there's an awful lot of really great listening content out there, so it means a lot that you chose this. You'll find a bunch of links in the show notes, including where you can learn more about those upcoming trips that Lauren mentioned. If you're listening to this in the spring of 2024, there is a bunch of trips going on through April, May and June that I'd highly recommend. Check it out anyway, regardless of when you're listening to this. I'm sure there will be other trips. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever, or even better, share it personally with a friend. Expect a new episode in a month or so. Much love. Take care. Thank you.